me go to worldbuilders.org here. Let's see what's going on here. Holy crap. You guys raised $500,000.
Oh, yeah.
When did that happen? I thought we were beating you for a while.
Oh, did you not check out yesterday?
What happened?
Yesterday was, today is Wednesday, the 2nd, when we're recording. But yesterday was Tuesday, December 1st. And it's something that I honestly only dimly was aware of, but they call it Giving Tuesday.
Mm-hmm.
And Amanda explained it to me like she does so many things. And she said, yeah, it's like sort of after you've poked yourself full of turkey and then you've had Black Friday and Small Business Saturday and Cyber Monday, they had the idea of like, why not Giving Tuesday, where you kind of try to ameliorate some of your karmic debt for being a crass consumer. And I'm like, oh, okay, that's cool. And we had a little bit of good news, which was that we were going to lead off with that day, which was that the site that we use for our main donation platform on Giving Tuesday was waiving their processing fee. So we're going to be like, hey, everyone, today's a great day to donate because we'll make even more money and they're being generous. So take them up on their offer. But then at like 7 o'clock at night, we got word from Heifer International, because we work with them and we're following all their feeds. They tapped us and they said, we have a big event for tomorrow. Could you help us spread the word? We're matching donations one for one, and all the proceeds are going to go to Haiti. And so we were like, oh my, and like they know, of course, that we're running our fundraiser now. So we contacted them. Like I called Vicky, who's our lifeline. She's our liaison to Heifer. I called her at 9:30 at night at home. And I'm like, can the money we raise tomorrow count towards your matching? And so like she had to talk to somebody and work it. And they effectively, we learned yes, but we learned it like 2 hours before the fundraiser was starting. So I wrote a whole blog. You know, Haiti is a little personal to me because my mom, you know, years and years ago went to Haiti to help run an unfunded orphanage in Port-au-Prince, and came back with a lot of stories. And that was one of the first times I realized that a lot of the world is really not like America, you know, and a lot of people don't have food or water or jobs or hope or anything. And so I wrote a blog and I said, hey, everybody, Heifer International will match your donations. And I wasn't planning on doing anything like this year, but I said, if you donate, I will match you. And then Heifer will match both of us.
Wow. I did see that on your blog. You had said that you would match up to $100,000, which is just a ridiculous and just an insanely generous amount of money. And it looks like, did you raise that much?
We stomped that flat by about 12:30 in the morning, apparently.
Good Lord, you're not even awake by 12:30 in the morning.
Exactly. I mean, I wrote that blog all night trying to get it right. I had to dig through pictures, found pictures of my mom, found a couple of pictures of her in Haiti. And then I finally launched it, I think, maybe around 6 or 7 in the morning, and then collapsed, you know, into sleep because I haven't been sleeping very much either these days. And I woke up and it was going smashingly well. We raised people donated more than $200,000 yesterday.
Wow.
And then there was my $100,000. And then Heifer is matching, you know, Heifer's people are matching that. So overall, the total good done to Haiti is better than $600,000. So yeah, the red bar is is very muscly right now. I'm very proud of that red bar on our fundraiser page on the thermometer.
For people who don't know, I mean, I think that it's possible there's people listening to the podcast who don't actually know what World Builders is. Could you give the kind of elevator pitch for World Builders?
Oh, sure.
and talk about what people can do? What's available today, how people can support it?
And for those of you that listen to the podcast, but you might not check out my blog, and so you wouldn't know about World Builders, it's a charity that I started kind of by accident. We've been doing it for a couple of years now. And you can check us out at worldbuilders.org. And you get to see all the different things we're doing. If you donate directly to our page, you'll be entered in a big lottery and eligible to win like many, 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 many games, many, many books, beautiful books and games from publishers and from authors and game designers. We're running auctions. We have a beautiful copy of The Adventures of Baron Munchausen signed, you know, personally to you by the guy that made it. You know, there's always auctions running. We have an online store. And this year, for the first time, something that I'm just thrilled about, Cards Against Humanity has done the Fantasy Pack. And any of those things that you do will support World Builders in our big end of year fundraiser. And then we give that money to Heifer International and they use it to make the world a better place.
Just I have trouble understanding like exactly what the impact of that is, but like what does that do for people to raise $1 million for Heifer International?
Well, it's, one of the things I like about Heifer is it's kind of easy to talk about it in concrete terms. I can say to people, if you donate $20, Heifer will go in and they will talk to people and they will teach them how to take care of chickens and how to build a pen for chickens and how to, you know, maybe sell the eggs after the chickens are laying eggs. And then they also give them a flock of chickens. So there's education as well as tools, materials, infrastructure, and then a gift of some sort, you know? And it's easy to think about chickens. It's only $20. And then they have a whole flock of chickens. That means the family, the kids. I mean, for kids, this is huge because eggs have a ton of nutrition in them. They have chefs and scientists refer to eggs as containing the perfect protein. They're so protein heavy. And you can eat those. And then your kids have a better diet. And you have a better diet. Plus, your chickens produce more chickens. And so then you have more chickens. You can also eat chickens. If you have a garden plot or a little farm, the chickens actually just run around your garden and eat bugs. And then your garden does better, you know, and plus they aerate the soil by pecking and scratching. Plus there's guano. And you can take the extra eggs and then you sell them. Then you have a source of income. Maybe you can like buy some better tin for the roof of your, you know, your shack, because a lot of these people, they're not living in houses. So it effectively, it gives you a constant source. You gain self-reliance in terms of your food, but at the same time, you get a little small business because you can sell these eggs, and that's a source of income you can use to improve your life in a bunch of different ways.
This is, I actually realize this is something I don't think I've ever asked you. How did you start? I sort of know the origin story of World Builders, that it came from, you know, having this extra merchandise and realizing that it was valuable and you could sort of do something to help people with it. But why Heifer? I'm curious, is it because of your mom, or how did that relationship kind of come about?
You know, it kind of all came together at the same time. There was a bunch of, I don't know, I suppose you'd say convergent events or something like that. Where, I was brought up right. You know, I had kind and generous parents, and that's just like a flat out statement I will make. they were good people, and so I had that luxury in my life of parents who had set a good example for me, who thought of other people and who were considerate of other people consistently through their lives. And then like Heifer kind of came into my awareness a couple of different ways, but you know, and you might not know about this. This was ages ago, like 9, 10 years ago, where Sarah McLachlan, who's a musician who I enjoy, did a song called World on Fire and did a music video, you know, because like she's absolute A-list musician. And so, you know, the album was, I think the album might've been called World on Fire as well. And it was the title track. And so she gets to make a music video. And so you see this video come out and the resolution of the picture is not good. It's obviously in somebody's living room. And there's a stool, you know, Sarah McLachlan comes in, sits on the stool with an acoustic guitar, and the camera is moving a little bit. You can tell somebody's just holding a video camera. Mm. And so she starts playing and singing, and it says, and then some block lettering comes onto the screen. It replaced black background and honestly really crude block lettering, with no good formatting, no good kerning. Like as a designer, you would look at that and you would go, oh, for the love of God. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't Comic Sans, but it was a close cousin. And so, you know, and it said, what's wrong with this video? And then it cuts back to her and you see her playing this music and singing this song. And then it cuts back to the text and it says, normally a music video costs $250,000. And then it cuts back to her again. And then it goes back to the text and says, this video cost $40. What did we do with the rest of the money? And then as the music is playing in the background, it says, it would make comparisons and say, normally a director for a music video costs $40,000. Instead, we built a school in Kenya. And then it would show some footage of a little girl sitting at a desk in Kenya watching a teacher explain things at a blackboard. And then it said, normally the catering for a 2-day video shoot costs $8,000. So instead, we built 20 wells providing fresh water in Nepal. And then it went through and it broke down the expenses of a music video and showed what it did. It's like they re-educated child soldiers. They helped homeless people.
They re-educated them to teach them how to not be soldiers, not to make them better soldiers.
Yes. Okay. Yes.
Okay. That could have gone either way.
Either way, it would probably be an improvement. But it's a, you know, and the thing is they said, you know, when they go, you know, this was put towards this cause. These people do good work in this area, and we've given them money so that they can do this good work. And of course, it brings it to you. You're like, oh boy, yeah, I do know that there are child soldiers, but what if they don't want to be child soldiers anymore? If you've been, because I mean, honestly, child soldiers are one of the most terrifying things in existence because children make really great remorseless killing machines because they have no ethical gray. And if you raise them, it's this horrifying thing that's done very deliberately in a lot of countries. You get these kids and you teach them to be remorseless bastards and they will take guns and they will kill people.
Wow.
And they will be the worst thing ever because they're absolutely sure they're right. If you think like what our military, I mean, why do we draft people? Why do we get people into the military when they're 18? Because their brains are still formative and we can do a really good job like turning them into killing machines. But that's got nothing on a 6-year-old The whammy they can put on those kids is amazing. So anyway, this World on Fire video did this, and it was, first off, it was an amazing idea, and it was amazingly well executed, this video. And at the end of it, they said, and that's where the money went. And then there was a link, and you could follow it, and you could look at all of the charities they had donated the money to. And one of those charities was Heifer International. And I wandered in and I looked around, and I'd already been exposed to them in little bits and pieces in other places. But, you know, it finally clicked. You know, and we had talked about this at one point down in Chicago, where you're like, you'd heard something on, what was the name of the show?
RoboCop? I don't know.
It was a podcast, where they talked about like animal charities or things like that, and how, you know, a lot of people were like, maybe this isn't.
Oh, that's right. I remember. I'm going to see if I can find this and put the link in the show notes. But I heard, I actually forgot. I totally forgot about this. There was a really good This American Life, and they went to interview these economists, and the economists had decided there were these sort of academic economists, and they got curious, and they were like, okay, we understand the logic of buying someone a cow, but what if you just gave people the money that the cow cost, and you just gave them the money? Maybe there's other more urgent things, or more, you know, maybe they would do other things with it. You know, I don't know, maybe they just go gamble it away, who knows? And they actually wound up doing this. I believe they did the experiment on a pretty small scale of, like, they gave one group the animals and they gave one group the money, and the people who they gave the money to did pretty well,
and the people who did the animals
also did pretty well. It turns out that if people are really in need and then you help them, it's great for them. But I think it was just surprising that I think the surprising result was that the people who they just gave the cash to, they did pretty well for themselves. And then, you know, there's definitely that branch of the free market economists who are like, well, who are we to know what people, you know, what people need in their lives? Let's just give them the money and let the free market decide.
Right. Now, and we chatted about it a little bit. I've listened to the It was a really great discussion of that, and you know, because I knew about Kinja. I don't even know if Kinja is still a thing, where you can do microloans to people. And the big thing that is always the tipping point for me with Heifer is, you know, and it's true, like, there's a lot of people who, you know, that just kind of need some help getting by. And once, like, if only I could get on top of my credit card, then I wouldn't end up $20 short on my bills every month, and, like, my life could get better. But, you know, and while I respect these economists' opinion, and This American Life is a great show, and so I have a great deal of trust for them, part of the problem with just saying, hey, you know, people are smart, here's money, just get a better life, the problem with that is, you know, God, what's the quote from Men in Black? You know, people are smart. Well, no, a person is smart.
Right.
People are dumb, panicky individuals. And a lot of people, especially people who live in poverty and have been raised in poverty, they don't have there's actually a term for it. It's called generational poverty. And that exists here in the US. And the way I describe it to people is, you know, if you've been brought up really poor, you go to the grocery store and you know that you only have $40 to do the grocery shopping. And so you buy, you know, a little bit of what you need so you can make sandwiches for the week for you and your kids. And you have the choice of buying the big jar of mayonnaise or the little jar of mayonnaise. And we all know that the little jar of mayonnaise is a total fucking ripoff. Because if you buy the big one, there's a lot more mayonnaise. It lasts forever. It's more efficient. It's a bargain because you're buying in bulk. However, you know, if all you have is $40, if you bought the big thing of mayonnaise, you couldn't afford everything else you need. So people who are poor they end up having, first off, this is just a systemic instance of how poverty is perpetuated. If you have money, you're able to be more efficient in your spending. And if you don't, like, it's the person that has a $500 car that they have to spend $400 every month fixing, mm-hmm. as opposed to somebody that can afford a new car and they don't spend anything on it for years. They both will spend the same amount of money, but the one guy has a shitty car all the time and probably has worse gas mileage. So anyway, a lot of people who are raised in poverty have learned to make choices that make total sense in a certain situation, for example, buying the small jar of mayonnaise. But when given more resources, they continue to make the same bad decisions, and so their lives don't improve. And what they really need is effectively re-education. And you can expand this particular small example into many areas. What Heifer does a lot of times, sometimes people come to Heifer and they're like, we need goats. We need goats. If you give us goats, we will have milk and we can sell milk and we can have a dairy and we can make cheese. And so Heifer comes into their community and they talk to them. They look at the local landscape. They look at the ecology. They look at the climate. They look at their culture. And they say, goats would not be good here. Goats would overgraze this soil. Goats would not survive well in this climate. Although honestly, goats survive almost everywhere. They're a really great animal. And they go, what you really need, you need fruit trees. Like, all of your soil is washing away because you've overforested. And so they're like, let's give you tree seedlings. And then these trees will grow and they will provide fruit and nuts, which is a cash crop, which gives you money. And it's playing the long game. But, as a gamer, what's the game that wins? The long game wins. The long game always wins, statistically. And so what they do is they go in, they're like, here, let's plant trees. Let's prevent soil erosion. And suddenly, everyone's gardens are doing better. And they go, by the way, you also need honeybees. And so they bring in honeybees. They teach them how to use them. And the people get honey and wax. And suddenly everybody's gardens are doing better. All the farms are doing better. Why? Because of better pollination. And then the bees swarm. And then there's more hives and more honey and more industry and more ready cash available. And that doesn't happen necessarily if you just drop $500 on a guy. Because he hasn't been doing this for 60 years, and he might not have all the pieces to the puzzle that he needs to really unpack the weird interconnected nature of the food chain.
If people want to learn more about World Builders, the show notes for this episode and every episode are available at www.unattendedconsequences.com. And I'm also going to put, in case you do not read Pat's blog, I'm also going to put the blog post where Pat talks about his mom's work in Haiti, which I found to be very moving. And I really, honestly, if you're listening to this podcast, I just couldn't recommend Pat's blog more. It is certainly one of the most considerate and most honest and earnest and just liveliest blogs on the internet, and I really truly love that thing. And I think if you enjoy listening to Pat on this podcast, you really should be following along with the blog and what's going on with World Builders.
Well, thank you, Max. That's very, very kind of you.
All right, I have some non World Builders questions for you. So while we were on break for the podcast, I came to visit. I saw your whole empire, and I came to visit in Stevens Point. It was a ton of fun. It was so cool to see all of the different setups and the buildings and the system you've got there. Where are you recording right now? Help me paint a picture for me.
I am actually right now. I'm in the workhouse.
Okay.
As distinct from the temple where World Builders lives. The workhouse is the place I initially bought because it was cheaper the mortgage on this really crapulent student rental was cheaper than renting an office for me to go and write in.
It's a cool house. I mean, it's kind of a, it feels to me like a kind of like a grown up clubhouse. Like it's, I mean, it really has a pretty remarkable collection of like gaming stuff. There's the minis. With that mini system that you have collected is just like an incredible collection. You have the games, the books, and then it's like a whole house. There's like a kitchen and a living room. It's a really nice setup.
It is kind of like my fort, you know? And for a while we ran World Builders out of it until it was really apparent that we needed more space. But yeah, that's where I am now. I'm not up in my writing room.
Mm-hmm.
I actually, because I've been streaming every day for,
as now, part now, of- the writing room, let me fill in our listeners. So, yeah, so I saw the, oh yes. So we went to the writing house, and there were a few places on the tour of the Pat Rothfuss Empire that I was not allowed in. As a mere mortal, I was not allowed in. One of them was the home office where you live with your family, and that was mostly, I think, because I might have had an aneurysm if I went in there due to reasons of messiness.
Disturbingly cluttered and
chaotic. Although the parts of the house that are not under your domain, the parts of the house that are Sarah's, charming.
Yes, Sarah is a force for good in my little world.
It's like a crazy, you know, Rockwell painting of like a family home. It's just like it's like the happiest place I've ever been.
Sarah's pretty great.
Oh, no kidding. And then okay, but at the workhouse upstairs, there's just a closed white door, and on the door there are three sheets of lined 8.5 by 11 notebook paper. And they're one on top of another. And the top one says, Pat's writing room. And it's kind of this note, red Sharpie, taped on the wall. And then immediately underneath that, it says, there is no reason for you to open this door. And then immediately under that, there's a third note. Like, I could see the train of thought as you were taping these up on the door. The last one just says, seriously, stay the fuck out.
Yeah. Yeah, it's because, you know, we fixed up part of the rental so that if people came to visit, they could crash here. And I love having guests. I love it when people come to visit and they can have their own space. There's a kitchen, you know, we got a nice bed here. But then I'm like, you know, I don't want people in my fucking writing room. But if I went to a house and somebody said, you may go anywhere in the castle, but the West Wing is forbidden. You know, it's like, where's the first place you've got to go? You know? And so I taped those up, you know, one after another. And I'm like, I can't just tell people not to. I really have to drive it home.
It's quite clear.
Everyone who has crashed here has had kind of the same reaction. Paul and Storm crashed here during a tour once, and they're like, he said, I've never wanted anything more than to go into that room.
But there is, I mean, you must see that there is something. Okay, here's what intrigues me about this. There is something like out of your, it is like something right out of your book. In that, it's like the J.J. Abrams, the mystery box talk that he gave?
No, I don't know about that.
It was a TED talk. I mean, I think you could skip it, but the nut of it was, you know, it's like you show the viewer a box, and the viewer wants to know what's in the box. And the mystery of what's in the box is better than anything that could be in the box. So sure. as a creative person, as a creator, he wants to preserve that mystery box with as much integrity as possible. And I think that's both what makes his work so compelling, but also some of the criticism of his work, right? Like Lost was just question after question. And ultimately, you know, someone who was obsessed with Lost and, you know, I did a podcast like rewatching every episode of Lost, like that mystery box was just such an unbelievable creative achievement. And, you know, ultimately it didn't sort of, I can't remember the word you said, but it didn't cash the check to the reader.
Yeah, I think I usually refer to it as paying the reader, you know?
Yeah, it didn't pay the reader. That's it. It didn't pay the reader at the end. And, you know, obviously, like with Star Wars, like I have been burned 3 times, 100% of the time in my lifetime when I've been able to go make a decision to go to the theater to see a Star Wars film, I have been burned so badly. I talked myself into it, and I was like, this one's going to be different, and I'm going to love this one. It's going to be awesome, and they fixed all the problems. And I got so badly burned by it. And yeah. I find, despite all of my best instincts, like, this movie has been handled so well. The mystery box is intact. I want to know what's in there. I want to go see the movie and see what it's about. And I think that's really brilliant marketing, as well as just brilliant storytelling, you know, for the people who are going to go see that film. But, you know, I can't help but feel like one of the things that just has me, like, salivating for the third book is I want to know what's in those doors. And yeah. And this is part of the thing about, you know, I think people look at you as and your sort of story as an author of, you know, kind of coming out of nowhere with this incredible first novel, and I think people want to know what's in that door, what goes on in there.
Yeah, that's something that comes, I don't know if it comes naturally to me, but at this point it's a real firm part of my craft. And I think you're right. You hit on something where in terms of marketing, the mystery box is 100% brilliant marketing, and useful marketing and even genuine marketing, which is kind of a rare thing, especially when what you're marketing is like a movie, you know? And in terms of the craft of narrative, I'll say the mystery box is perhaps as much as half of, like, narrative mastery. And, you know, the other half, of course, well, it's a bunch of things, but a big part of the other half is what's in the box.
Yeah. You know?
You know, I wanted to, first off, I wanted to thank you. Like Max said, he came for this visit. It was such a treat. It was such a treat to get to hang out socially. And the next one is on me. I'm going to be coming down to Chicago to see him. I'll bring the kids. We'll probably hit a museum and have a good time.
Big fan of your kids.
Oh yeah,
they're really fun. I usually don't like children, so I wouldn't, I would tell you if I thought they sucked.
You know, and I have to say, and this is why I brought it up, I got to tell people this too. Max came up, and I will say, I didn't know that you weren't that into kids. Max was a champ, you know, hit the ground running with the kids.
Wait, what are you going to do with a kid? They're like drunk adults. It's like, it's really hard to hold a conversation, and they don't know what's going on. Who wants to hang out with kids? But, oh man, your kids are a treat. Like, they're super smart, and they're extremely considerate, and just also, like, watching you, stop me if this is not something you want to talk about publicly.
No, but, like, I talk about, like, kids all the time.
God, like, watching you talk to Oot is a really special thing. I mean, I wonder what the best way to describe this to people is. I mean, there was, when we went to get brunch, and something went wrong with his order. He didn't get exactly the food that he wanted, and for those of you who have spent any time with, you know, young, how old is he? Four or five?
He's just turned six.
Oh, just turned six. Okay. What do I know? It's like they're either a baby or I could hire yep. them is basically all I care about. So he just turned six. So for a kid, for a 6 year old, something goes wrong with their food order, that could be devastating. I mean, that could be a tantrum. It could be a sort of apocalyptic rage filled event, and I could see he was going that way. I mean, he was really not happy with the way that the breakfast was working out for him, and you sort of lifted him up, and he sat on your knee, and you were like, tell me how you're feeling, and what do you think about this, and what can we do to, you know, what kind of will getting really angry make it better, and what kind of steps could we do to remedy this? And, like, man, it was just like watching you talk. It was like hostage negotiations. It was like watching you talk someone down off a cliff. It was unbelievable.
Well, you know, it's again, I will credit the fact that I had really good parents. I think a lot of people, they're like, I'm worried about having kids because what if I'm a bad parent? My parents were bad parents. and what if I'm a bad parent too? Some people have kids and they're like, and their main goal is they're like, I want to be a good parent because my parents weren't good. For me, it was intimidating. Had the thought of having kids. It's like the best I can do is to be as good as my parents were. But so I have that going for me. Sarah also very baby savvy, very kid savvy. And she's a baby geek and a kid geek. And she was a psychology major and like, will read a book about child discipline for fun, you know? So like, and so we talk about it a lot and, you know, I get human motivation and that sort of thing. And, you know, and I've been lucky enough to be able to take the time to focus on these things because I have not had to worry about maternity leave and because I have not had to worry about how can I make enough money, you know, if my kid gets sick. You know, I've been able to focus a lot of my time and energy on these things because I've been in a very good position. I also enjoy it. I realize now that I am also a kid geek.
I mean, that I would say that seems to be the key thing to me because I see so many, you know, I'm out with you know, people, friends of mine who have kids or whatever, and like, or just you see people with kids, and their first instinct is a kid starts crying or they get upset about something stupid. Kids are always upset about something stupid, and you know, their brains are mush. They don't know what's going on, but you know, kids that gets upset about something stupid, and people, their first instinct is to yell at them, like, what the hell are you doing? Like, you know, or this is the way it is. Like, it's not a debate. It's not an argument. And it's just like, you just came into the situation with so much empathy and you really saw it from his point of view and how upsetting it would be to not get the food you wanted and to not have the day work out how you wanted and started from a place of relating to him and then brought him up to your level of seeing it in perspective.
Well, thank you. You know, I've not always been there. I've brushed up against being a bad dad a few times.
Was it the time you trained your children to be soldiers, child soldiers?
there was one time where, and this is a little thing. It's something he will never remember. It will not have an impact on his life. But, you know, it's one of those things like as the kid will never remember and the parent will never forget. There were two instances I can think of. One of them, he was a very little baby, like 6, 7, 8 months, you know, like, so like really no language at all. He could sit up and that's about it. Can't walk, can't talk. You know, and he could learn. They're still intelligent at that age. And one of the things we'd worked on is like, you don't pull daddy's beard. Cause early on it's fun to do. You put your hands in it. It's nice, you know, and he might tug on it because he's just learning to interact with the world. But then we say, no, 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 you don't tug. You be gentle. That's one of the first things you teach a kid is gentle, you know, gentle touch, be nice. And you can teach that very early. They get that. They understand that. So he'd reached out and he'd grabbed the beard. And for those of you that don't have beards, right, imagine I would rather have somebody grab a handful of my pubes and yank as hard as they could. Well, think your face is incredibly sensitive. You know, your face is incredibly sensitive. Your mouth, all of this face skin is incredibly sensitive. And like just getting your regular hair pulled hurts. But imagine that, except your scalp is not terribly sensitive. But imagine that happening on one of the most sensitive parts of your body. So anyway, I'm sorry for that pube analogy. And he grabbed the beard and gave it a little tug with deliberation, you know, like we had worked on this. He knew better. You know, I knew, and you can kind of read their minds at that age because they look at the beard, they move their hand toward, they close their hand on the beard, and then he looks you in the eye and he looks down and then he pulls. And you can tell he's testing his boundaries because he knows he shouldn't, but how much shouldn't he?
That should be a t-shirt that I wear.
What's that?
I know I shouldn't, but how much shouldn't I?
It's how we're wired. It's like a fundamental process of our brains. That's the human condition there in a nutshell.
Yeah, no kidding.
But all of that happens in half a second. He reaches out, looks down, looks up, and then pulls, and it hurts. And so I let a little bit of that into my voice, and I kind of bark at him because it does catch me by surprise because he does know better, and it does hurt. And, you know, honestly, I was probably cranky or tired or had low blood sugar. But I won't be able to do it, like, not in the moment. But I said, no. Except I barked it a little bit more. I went, no. And he stopped. And I might have said his name, too, which I'm not going to do here on the podcast.
Yeah.
But I barked it out at him. And so he stopped, and he didn't, and he kind of looked away, and he didn't burst into tears or anything, but, and then I'm like, okay, you know, he knew, that's what you have to do. You have to say no, you have to be firm, you have to let him know, whatever. And then, you know, it's maybe 30 seconds later or a minute later, and I kind of reach out to kind of like touch him or move him or cuddle him or pet him because, you know, they're babies. You just want to touch them all the time. But when I touch him, his body is wet. I barked at him and he was so afraid that he broke out into a sweat.
Wow.
That's
terrifying.
Yes, you get it. You get it. And that happened. And I thought right then, I'm like, you got to get this shit in line right now, Rothfuss. That's not in any way acceptable for your child to be terrified like that over a relatively minor thing. This wasn't even a big discipline issue. It's just him respecting what no means when he means it. And I'm like, but him being so afraid that he sweats cold, that's wrong. You have gone too far. Get your shit in order. That's, you know, that's me talking to myself. And there was another moment that happened probably within 3 months. He was older because something happened downstairs. I came downstairs and as I was coming down the stairs, I saw him doing something. I can't remember what the specifics were.
But isn't that the whole story though? It doesn't matter. You can't remember what it was, but you remember your specific overreaction to it.
Yep. It was dangerous and it was naughty. And so I snapped at it again, except I was at the top of the stairs. He was in a different room. And so I actually shouted, which I'm not going to do here because it'll pin out all of these sensitive microphones and everything. And I shouted his name and I was angry, you know, because, you know, again, he's older, he knows better. And I shouted and he was kind of in mid run. I think he was running away from whatever it is he had just done that he knew he shouldn't. And it was bad and it was dangerous because that's where a lot of the anger comes from, is fear for your child. So he was running away and I shouted and he actually went down, he stopped running and he went down into a crouch. He went down into a little huddled crouch where like his hands came in and his head went down.
Oh, that's so pathetic.
Yep. And he actually like shook.
Oh man, you monster.
It was like a raw animal reaction to like the biggest fucking gorilla in the world. And then, you know, that the little thing where I raised my voice to him too much as a baby, and then that thing, and I'm like, okay, it's like you have so much power over this child. Just your voice is a bludgeon to him. You know, you had better, and you've been raising him to be gentle and to be kind. And I haven't exposed him to violence in media. And I haven't, you know, exposed him to all of these other culturally poisonous things. So he gets to be innocent for a long time, and he gets to experience wonder and love and not just mindless violence and empty action and explosions and whatever. And but as a result, he is more delicate. And so, and I'm like, this is it. You got to get your shit under control, Rothfuss. And so I did. And so at this point, I had pretty good vocal control before. I'm a performer. I've been a teacher. I used to sing in choirs. I've preached sermons. Pretty persuasive. But now I'm nigh unto like Bene Gesserit levels of voice control. And so like, you know, and but honestly, what you learn with kids is that like anger and shouting, they do have a very small place and they are useful tools, but that's not going to win you the war. You play the long game, and the long game is always you talk to the kid, you listen to the kid, got to listen, you got to believe them, you got to trust them, and you got to explain everything more than once, you know, because how else are they going to learn about the world? And again, I will credit Sarah with a lot of that. She has been a huge part of me becoming a good father.
Well, I think that is probably a good place for us to end, I think. Although I do have a challenge for you.
Uh-oh. What do we got?
So we've talked about bringing back the some of these challenges, although maybe in a less formal way. But I could not help but notice that when I visited your home, there was the one forbidden room. That was not the writer's room. It was Daddy's special office.
What's, yeah, the chaos bomb office. Yeah.
What's going on? What is that? What's going on in there? I gotta know. I know I shouldn't, but how much shouldn't I?
Well, imagine. Let me see. Let me think of a good analogy here that doesn't involve pubes. Imagine if you were like, if you were a person, right? And you were very obsessive and you did not care very much about appearances or traditional organization or cleanliness or what people thought about, your workspace, because you knew that they would never see it.
You lost me.
And you spent perhaps upwards from like somewhere between 6 and 14 hours a day in front of your computer doing everything from email to writing to gaming to eating most of your meals there, storing books around you, moving things there from other parts of the house that just didn't fit there. And then, and you know how a normal person, it would go like a month or two. It's like the dishes. Here's my analogy, right? Everyone, very few people will always do the dishes after they eat, right? Do you do the dishes right after you eat?
In general, yes.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. We found our difference, Max. Mm-hmm. We're very similar in so many ways.
Well, here's what it comes down to for me, because I know we've talked about that we both struggle with some of the same anxiety issues with anxiety and procrastination and things like that. And for me, there's a lot tied into my love of organization and my love of like a clean workspace. The first thing is the most simple level is I'm a procrastinator. I'm a very, very bad procrastinator. I mean, I really will wait until the last minute to do things. And the more emotionally difficult it is for me to do, the more I'll procrastinate. And it's very much like an anxiety thing. And I know that as I'm procrastinating that it's not helping and that I'm making it worse and that I should just do it. And I don't. In those moments where I wake up or I have the right amount of coffee or who knows what goes right. And it's like, I could do this right now. I'm going to sit down and grind it out and do this thing. if I can't find the piece of paper I need in that moment, or if I cannot find, you know, the whatever it is, a pencil, a pad of notepaper, you know, the computer accessory, whatever it is I need to get the job done at that moment, that's it. Then it's done. I had the moment and it left me, because the minute I have to get up to like go get the right office supplies or fix some technical problem on my computer to be able to do my work, it's like there goes the day. I had it and I lost it. So in sort of anticipation of waiting for the mood to strike to work, I like to know where my stuff is and have that organization. So that's the first part of it. The second part of it is, I think it's kind of when I start feeling like things are out of control, like I you know, things are moving quickly or I don't know, just that's a big part of my life now, is just being a part of these big things and ultimately kind of accepting that they're out of my control. I really resort to cleaning and organizing, because cleaning and organizing is something I can control.
That makes a ton of sense. And actually, you know, what's weird, and this is how much I've been playing Fallout lately. What you described, and I'm like, actually, that does make sense rationally, but also emotionally, because that's what I've been doing in Fallout. I've been streaming Fallout every day and I've been playing it. And I'm like, this little town that I've built is very well organized, you know, and I've actually built things to organize it better and move things. And there are separate lockers for different types of equipment. And I would never do that in my real life. And I don't know what that indicates. Because for me, and here's my process. Here's where I think we diverge. For one, I'm never consciously aware or irritated. I have a very limited awareness of the impact of my surroundings on my mood. I have become aware of this because here's one of the first examples. I was going to throw a party, just a little get together back in college. And so I'm like, what do I need? And I think of all practical things. I think I want the house should be clean so that people will be happy that it's clean. I want, you know, a table where people can play games. I want food that people can eat. I want movies that people can watch. These are the things that will make this gathering a success. And Sarah came over because for some reason it was a party that both of us were doing. It's not really a party. There was like maybe 8 or 10 people getting together. And so she came over and she like brought a lamp. and I'm like, I've got a lamp. And what I have in the corner is one of those halogen death lamps, you know? Where like you turn it on, you could actually cook food on it. Mm-hmm. They don't sell them anymore because they would light people's houses on fire. But I had it because what do I want out of a light? I want huge blinding, you know, lumens coming out of this thing. And it does. It lights up an entire room. But Sarah brought over a lamp and like put it somewhere and moved a chair. And then she put like a handkerchief over the lamp and it colored the light. And I'm like, excuse me, could you fucking help me get ready for this party? I know that you're just kind of like doing like fairy dances in there, but I am making taco dip. People need to eat food at our party. I was angry. But then, you know, people showed up and it was the best little gathering. And it turned into like a makeout party, actually. And I know it wasn't because of the taco dip. I'm pretty sure that was because like it was a really comfortable place. And it felt nice to be in that room. But that's something I would never do. Like, I've lived in my current house for 5 years. And I think I hung up a picture once. That's it. You know? And I don't think that picture is still hanging up. I think.
Oh, Pat, thank God you have Sarah. I mean, it would really, what a disaster your house would be.
Oh, it'd be fine for me, but for any other human being, you know. So anyway, so that's my mindset, is I'm completely oblivious to these things. And whereas a normal person, it's like maybe you don't do the dishes for a day or two or three. And then you look at that and you're like, oh, I've got to take care of this. And a slob would let it go for 2 weeks. And like a monster would let it go for 4 weeks. I apparently never have, especially if I'm busy, I always default to, I will take care of this later. But later, if I'm constantly busy, which I always am, later is indefinitely postponed, literally forever. I will actually literally forever. And so all the things that I want to clean up, you know, at one point I remember looking around because I will order a sub for lunch and eat it while I'm doing email just because I'm so busy. And so I looked around the room and there were like at least 15 delivery bags just sitting within arm's reach of the desk. You know, it's not like there was food garbage. I mean, because that's a practical consideration. Food garbage rots and smells, and I dispose of that appropriately. But paper bags are of no threat to me. This is not a problem.
Mm-hmm. But what about this? In terms of, let me make a practical argument. What about when your work room, you know, your office space is not full of stuff? It's the opportunity of being able to do stuff in there. So like you could have a blackboard on the wall and write on the wall if it wasn't, you know, covered in stuff, or, you know, you could have all of your things, your books organized. So when you needed one, you could find it quickly.
No, actually, like I can usually find everything because, you know, because people like you will put something in a cupboard thinking now I will know where it is. And it's in a place and it's orderly. Mm-hmm. Me, I will be like, here's everything covering every flat surface in my house. I do not need to open a cupboard door to get at it. I will be able to look at it, see it, find it, pick it up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I don't just randomly cram things into cupboards with no sense. Like I put the water glasses over the sink so that when I need a glass of water, I have the shortest travel distance to get a glass and put it under the sink. And then if it was up to me, there'd be a little label on the cupboard that said water glasses.
You know, you can buy a labeler super cheap, man, like $20.
Oh, at the office, we're crazy for labels. Everything's labeled. Yeah. Veronica's drawn a line in the sand where I'm not allowed to label everything. Like if it was up to me, the cat would come into the room and she'd have a little label on her head. Cat.
We did that once. Actually, I think somebody bought a labeler at World Builders, and for a while it was pure madness. Everything got labeled. So it's not gross. You know, it's not, there's not filth involved, because I am the person who will quite literally, I'll let my dishes go for a long time, but they're not filthy. They're not gross. There's not mold. There's not, you know, mess in the sink. They'll just be stacked on every available countertop, dry, but you know, dirty. They'll have particulate waste on them, because that particular toggle is broken in my head.
Well, here's my proposal. I think I've been watching you guys make all of these videos for World Builders. So you have all these celebrities, you know, John Green is like gargling a thing of whiskey.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
You terrified your child with the cinder mannequin. Where he, by the way, Oot took it so much better than I did.
Yeah. Yeah, actually, that was the even younger one. That was Cutie.
Oh, the Cutie, right. Yeah, Cutie took it so much better than I did. That thing freaked me out.
I knew that he would be a little, like, I thought he would be creeped out by it. For those of you that don't know, we have a life-size, like, 6-foot-tall, somebody who does, who studied practical effects, did it as their graduation project over in, I think in Denmark, made a stunning life-size cinder statue.
It's very upsetting.
It's terrifying. It's truly terrifying. Black eyes in this.
I'm gonna put the video of Cutie meeting Cinder on the in the show notes here.
And maybe we won't give it away, but you'll see when Cutie it lives in World Builders Central because the guy donated it, and and they had to move it into the basement because it kept freaking everyone out. They would see it out of the corner of their eye, and so I'm like, I know what we'll do for charity. Let's expose my not yet 2-year-old child to this horrific thing. And what happened might surprise you.
Well, here's my proposal.
Okay.
I think as a World Builders sort of stretch goal. If you raise some, you know, certain amount of money, I come down to Stevens Point and organize your office.
Oh, that's horrifying.
And I have conditions.
Oh no! Oh, yeah. You really put some thought into this.
Oh yes, I've been thinking about this. Okay. I have conditions. So at the moment that I enter the office, so basically you have between, you know, now and whenever I enter the office to do what you want with the place. But at the moment that I enter, I want carte blanche to throw whatever is in there right in the garbage.
Oh my God.
We're not donating it. We're not putting it in a storage unit. We're not giving it to other people. Big contractor bags coming in. It's going out to the dumpster. You know, you got one life to live. You got to make some space. It's going. It's getting. We're not screwing around here. It's all going.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. You'll never miss it or notice that it's gone.
Wow. You know, I'm gonna have to think about that.
We're gonna get you like a chalkboard in there. We're gonna get you like a bookshelf, and you'll be. It's gonna be such a. You're gonna like that more than your forbidden right. Your mystery box room.
You know, I would, and the truth is, occasionally, like, you know, what happens to me is I listen to an audiobook, mm-hmm. and I'm like, I'm listening to my audiobook, and everybody's out of the house, I should clean up my crap. And so I do, I take a pass, and I clean off my, and it's so nice having a clean desk, having it a little tidier in there. I know I enjoy it, but I never do it.
We're gonna go to the office supply store. We're gonna get like new pads of paper and like whatever your favorite pen is. We're gonna go get literally a mason jar full of them. You will never need another pen again for the rest of your life.
Man, my shelves are. Well, you know, and the thing is, I trust you. I trust you to make good decisions. I mean, I have.
Well, you'll be there. I mean, you can protest as I throw things out.
Right. But I'm like, you wouldn't throw away any of these genuinely rare and precious things.
Like your children?
I
would not throw your children out. Anything else is fair game.
Wow. Okay. You know, I appreciate the spectacle concept of this. This is what World Builders is all about, mm-hmm. and it ties in very nicely to the podcast. That's true. Where if you know, we are, it would be good for me to see how the pros do it and also to have a better working space. But, you know, right now we have stretch goals already up to $1 million. So we're full up to $1 million. We would have to do it at 1.1 million. I'm going to make people reach for that. If you want Max to like actually molest the heart of my working world visibly for
well,
you
don't,
all.
Well, don't put it like that. Well, hang on now. Think of how much more efficient Pat will be writing his book.
Oh, see, there you go. That's a much better pitch.
Right. The book will just, it'll just finish itself practically.
Wow, you sold me on it right there.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, how could you not write a book in an office like that?
Okay, you did. You actually you relaxed me a little bit. It would be genuinely nice to have, boy, the thought of you being able to carte blanche throw things away is a whole different flavor of terrifying.
I'm going to throw away a few good things just to drive you crazy because it's going to be really funny on film. But also, let me throw in one other thing. Think about how happy Sarah will be.
Oh, yeah. Okay, here, I got to see what stretch goals we actually currently, because we have a list of all of our stretch goals here on the World Builders page. We just finalized more of them. You know, because we had to put a bunch up because we had that huge day. We crushed like 8 of our stretch goals because of our huge day yesterday. We passed Neil Gaiman. Neil Gaiman's going to sing to his new baby for us.
Yeah, but how organized is his office, though?
Okay, so let me see. We've got that.
See, forget the charity, Pat. It's about, you know, you got to... are you the master of your domain?
Well,
are all of your books cataloged alphabetically with a card catalog system
by color and height?
No, that's insane. alphabetical by author's last name. By subject, if you want.
I have an elaborate sort of subject and value and sentimentality.
Sure, however you want to, whatever works. You don't do you don't do subject and then alphabetical by author's last name?
No, absolutely not.
How do you ever find a book that you want?
I know where they are because of my...
No, you don't. You do not know. Oh, I'm calling bullshit on that. You have no idea where your books are. Okay, you have too many books to know where they are.
And actually, that is partially true, but the main problem isn't the organizational system. It's that I have so many books now that I have literally run out of shelves. Literally run out of shelves. I'd need about another 100 feet of shelf space to put all my extant books up on shelves. Okay, but no, I'm on board. You've sold me on. I'm just wondering where we're gonna put it, because you're right. Let's tie it into the fundraiser.
Now, so if we do this in 1,000,001, have you ever raised that much money in 1 year for World Builders?
We have not. We have not. We have 12 days left,
mm-hmm.
and we always have a surge at the end. Like I said, at this point, like I don't want to jinx it. We already have the million stretch goal. We already have another one that's already queued up. Brett's done the art for the little card that we're going to do at the $50,000 increment after that. All they're waiting on is my official write-up. And so our next slot available is... It's 1.1.
All right, Pat. You got to raise that much money if we do this.
Well, I'm going to say if people want to watch this and want this to happen, that's the reason. That's why we call it a stretch goal. We got to make them reach for it.
All right. Oh man, I'm like, I just have the biggest grin on my face. This is going to be so much fun.
Oh no, I'm so terrified.
This is going to be the greatest. This is going to be the greatest thing that's ever happened.
Oh boy!
It's just gonna be a lot of shots of you with your face in your hands in the hallway, just moaning as I bring out contractor yes. bags full of garbage.
Sitting on the floor, rocking gently back and forth.
Yeah, this is awesome. I'm gonna have so much fun with this. We're gonna furnish the place. All the furniture's going. I'm bringing in new furniture. We're repainting in there. It's gonna be awesome.
Oh man, when you see my chair, you're gonna plot.
It's going right in the garbage. I don't even know what it is. It's going right in the garbage. We're getting you some sort of ergonomic Herman Miller chair.
Oh boy. Oh boy. Okay. I've given it my thumbs up. I'm not gonna take that back.
All right. Well, now I guess it's up to
the World Builders. It just occurred to me, when you see my desk itself, when you see what my desk is. Oh, okay. Yeah. Everybody's going to see it. You're going to see. I remember thinking, it was not too long ago, I looked around my office and I thought, if people knew how I lived, they would. It's like, I am an animal, how I live here. No adult human being exists in a space like this. And it's all natural. I didn't even think of it till now, like what my desk is. You'll see what my desk is. And yeah, okay. We'll do it. If we hit 1-1.
I'm like horrified, and I just cannot stop grinning about how fun this is going to be. Well, I have a good I'm not going to promise to tackle it this week, but I do have a similarly daunting project to help improve my life that I want to work on over the podcast, which is I really need to build a gaming PC and start playing Fallout 4.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
You know, really got to do the responsible thing and build a high-end gaming PC.
That's what I did. That's what I'm podcasting right now on the PC that I had built specifically so I could play Fallout 4.
That would, in all seriousness, that would be a huge disaster for my life. But I really do need to do it. I have not had a computer that I'm a Mac guy, and I have not had a computer that I could, and you know, I don't want to like dual boot into Windows or any of that craziness. So I just haven't had a computer I can like easily play games on in years and years and years. And Fallout 4 is the first game that's come along where it's like I really need to take some action on this. Like, I just want to play that thing with the graphics all the way up.
You know, here's my advice, right? Here's my thing to you, right? Mm-hmm. You could do this yourself. You could go down the rabbit hole. You could learn the new lore. But you'd be training up kind of from zero because of all the new stuff, especially if it's been that long for you. Mm-hmm. You know, and I know that there's a certain amount of pride involved because, like, I used to be a techno geek too. Like, I used to work in a computer lab. I used to be able to crack the university's security well enough to install games so I could play them on the university computers. So I was not an idiot. And these days, you know, like I've officially been left behind. And so even when I would make a computer, I'd get Dell, I'd build it on Dell and they'd ship me the computer or whatever ages ago. This one, I went to somebody and I said, you know what? I want a computer that is just, I want it to be bulletproof. I want smoke to be able to come out of one of the hard drives and never lose data. I want, if lightning strikes my house, I don't want this computer singed. You know, in 3 years, if a badass game comes out, I want to be able to play it in 3 years' time. I want this thing to be just like so overbuilt. This should be like the shadow wraith of computers. You know, they only made 8 of those. You know, I said, if you crack it open, like an infernal light should well up from the caged demon that powers it. You know, I said, do you get where I'm coming from? I go, and I want nothing. I want nothing. I don't want to choose anything. I want you to do all the choices. And the only thing you ask me about is the interface, because I need to be able to put my frickin' IBM Model M clicky keyboard into it and stuff like that. And he goes, okay. And he went off and he made the computer and he came back and it's done. And it was a treat, I tell you.
No, I gotta build it myself. I need to, really? Like, I need to go into the cave and see Darth Vader, you know?